Welcome, everybody. This is the fifth and final office hour session for the Mises Academy class, Adventures in Energy Economics, with me, Bob Murphy. And we are, the course is wrapped up at this point, so this is the final office hour session where I'm free to answer any of your questions. Okay, and as always, guys, go ahead and just type in your questions. You don't need to wait for the next, for me to answer the pending question. Okay, George Smith asks, are you still an anarcho-capitalist? If not, explain. Or please explain. He's being very polite. Okay, so, yes, I still am. If possibly what's throwing you is I decided a while ago, but let me make sure I'm not losing anybody because there could be some people who are taking this class that don't know that term. So the term anarcho-capitalist, I don't know if Murray Rothbard made it up. He certainly popularized it. And that just means, I mean, the two things going on there are the term anarchist and capitalist. And so what it means is it's somebody who thinks everything should be privatized. All right. So a lot of libertarians, whether they endorse it or not, certainly understand the case for and would think somebody's not crazy for believing that, you know, we don't need the post office doesn't need a monopoly in first class mail delivery. That the government should just get out of mail delivery altogether and just let market forces deal with that. And hey, if it ends up being three times as expensive to take a letter from New York to San Francisco, well, that kind of makes sense because it's pretty far away. You know, why should it cost the same to mail a letter from New York to San Francisco as it costs to mail it down the street? You know, so let market forces deal with that, and that'll be more effective use of resources. A lot of people even see why in education, you know, maybe the government shouldn't be involved at all in education. And if people are worried about whether poor kids can end up learning how to read and stuff, well, then you can set up private charitable foundations and things like that. And maybe all things considered, it would just be better if we didn't force kids to go to school who didn't want to, and we didn't take a bunch of money from people and pay for public school, so-called public schools that actually many criteria don't do that good job of educating kids anyway. All right, so you can see that even privatizing the roads, that's a little bit more radical for people, but kind of, you know, understand the arguments for that. But the thing that really trips a lot of people up, even self-described libertarians, is military defense and the legal system. The legal system, I think, is conceptually the hardest. Like, what would it even mean to privatize the courts and the police function? You know, how could you do that? And then there'd be no government at all, right? And that, and yes, that is the point, at least government in the sense that we mean, or you could say the state, if that's an easier term for people to realize what we're talking about. So Murray Rothbard and plenty of others in that tradition refer to that stance as anarcho-capitalism, the belief that all of the legitimate functions of the government should be privatized. And then notice that doesn't mean all the functions of the government should be privatized. So Rothbard, you know, points out, I don't think anybody should do what is now done in the name of taxation. So I don't want to privatize taxation. I just want to get rid of it. But the areas where the government dabbles in things that are legitimate services, like building roads and teaching kids how to read and adjudicating in disputes in criminal cases and civil cases, and then, you know, sending armed guys and women to go apprehend fugitives and things like lawbreakers. You know, these are things that Rothbard thought were legitimate functions that should be provided in a free society. He just didn't think there should be a coercive group that has a monopoly on the provision of those things, or at least claims the right to determine if it should have a monopoly, and that gets its funding from involuntary contributions, which is what the defining essence of a state is. So, yes, George, I still believe in that. I actually go further. I'm actually a pacifist. And so if you think about it, if you're a pacifist, then you have to be an anarcho-capitalist. It goes further, but I'm saying at the very least you're an anarcho-capitalist. You can't possibly be a statist while you're a pacifist, because the state by its very nature ultimately rests on the threat of force. And so, you know, in other words, if you had an organization that was supposed to be a state, But yet, if somebody disagreed with what it was doing and didn't want to contribute, and the worst that the state said was, well, okay, well, we're going to be over here and furrow our brow and not invite you to our parties, that wouldn't be a state. That would be a club. All right. What makes it a state is that it says, well, no, if you don't contribute to us like we tell you you should, if you don't pay us every year what we say you owe as your fair share, then we're going to send people with guns to come get you. So anyway, I'm an anarcho-capitalist, but what may be throwing you is I don't volunteer the term anarchist anymore. And the reason is it's partly rhetorical or strategic. I don't know what term you want to use, but it's just that term carries such baggage with it. If you say to somebody, oh, I'm an anarchist, I mean, for a lot of people, they think that means you don't believe in any rules whatsoever. And actually, as my acquaintances will tell you, I'm pretty anal. But, you know, I have all kinds of rules in my head about the way people ought to behave. It's just I don't think the rules should be backed up with guns. And so for me, the term anarchist is just needlessly confusing, and it turns people off when you say it up front. So I don't, that's not how I describe myself. If somebody asked me, you know, what are your views, I wouldn't just pop out and say, oh, I'm an anarchist, or I wouldn't even say I'm an anarcho-capitalist unless I'm in a group of Rothbardians. I know that they're going to know exactly what I mean by the term. So if you want me to talk more about it, I will, but that's the quick answer. Okay. Oh, Matt Miller says, are those free advice mugs for sale? I don't know. Well, some guy gave me this for free. He was starting a mug company. Well, I think he was putting designs on all kinds of stuff, including mugs. And so he did these for free. You can kind of see it has the fractal logo on the other. This is old. That's why it's faded. But I can't remember if he was selling them for people, but it would have been a long time. I wouldn't even know how to track him down at this point. Okay. Matt Miller asks, I've noticed that a lot of the more famous libertarians, authors, speakers, etc., are religious, but a large amount of the rank and file libertarians are atheists. Do you have any guess as to why this might be the case? Okay. First of all, I am not sure if it's true, if your premise is true. I mean, strictly speaking, the words you said are correct, but I think what you're trying to get at is you're saying it seems like the proportions are different. That of the prominent libertarians, it seems like a higher fraction of them are religious than among the rank and file. And so what I'm saying is I don't know if that's actually true. Because what happens, like take my blog, for example, Free Advice, for people who don't know. So in case people are confused, I'm Christian, and there's lots of other people, especially associated with the Mises Institute, who are Catholic. And so, you know, there's that element, whereas it's true, there are a lot of people who are libertarian who are coming. Like, we're brought into, like, I think Ayn Rand's really great and, you know, agree with her position on religion and so on, or even not if you're an objectivist, but just the libertarian. There are plenty of people who are atheists and not merely, it's not like just a little, you know, opinion on their part. Like, they will tell you at length why they're an atheist and why anyone who believes in religion is crazy. But what I'm saying, Matt, is I don't know if it's actually the case that the proportions are different among the prominent, you know, in the public eye ones versus the rank and file. It certainly comes across that way on the internet, but for example, so every Sunday on my blog, I do religious posts, and then on the other 6 days of the week, I just talk about economics and stuff. And it's true, if you went and looked at those posts, you would think there was me and maybe one or two other people in the comments who were religious versus 8 or 9 hardcore atheists who were just merciless in their denunciations of my position. And like, you know, just wondering aloud, how could you be such a good economist about 6 days a week, but every Sunday you suddenly turn into a moron? But what I'm saying, what you're not seeing though, is I get a lot of emails from people privately saying, hey, I really love your Sunday post. I don't even bother getting into those arguments because those people, you know, just butt your head off and there's no reasoning with them. All right. So it's, you might very well be right. I don't know. I'm just saying you can't go off of the fact of what happens in the comment section, because if there's a bunch of, you know, if there's just 10 guys who just will denounce you and go crazy like a cat dogs on you if you say, you know, you think that maybe the Old Testament might have some wisdom for us, well, then a lot of religious people don't even feel like having that argument, so they don't want to volunteer that they're religious and then get attacked. So that, I think that's part of what might be driving your perception of this huge disparity. I think maybe the disparity is not as big as you think, and it's just a lot of religious people. Let me put it this way. The only people with the courage to say, hey, by the way, I'm libertarian and I believe in God, are the ones who have their position firmly established because of their work and their speaking and stuff, and they know they can get away with saying it. Whereas if you're just some Joe Schmo and say, by the way, I'm religious, you just might get, you know, ostracized and feel like nobody wants you around anymore, and that you're not a real libertarian. How the heck could you possibly be a libertarian if, you know, didn't you see what it says about sodomy in the Old Testament? What's wrong with you, right? So I think that's part of it. Okay. Malcolm says, in the writings that were assigned, the concept of peak oil is discussed. Do you think such a thing of peak oil, even if very much of the future exists? How do you see the markets playing out with and without regulation? Okay, so for people who don't know, I mean, peak oil is this idea that the I'm blanking out on what the guy's name was. There was, you know, some guy who originated the hypothesis, and he, and then, like I said, I'm just drawing a blank on the guy's name. And then he originally set it for the United States, and peak oil referred to output. So the prediction wasn't that the world was going to suddenly be devoid of oil. The specific predictions were, you know, first couched in terms of the United States, I think, and then in terms of the world, in different time frames in which, hey, U.S. oil output is going to peak at a certain point, and then it's going to decline, and then and the same thing for the world. And there were different, and then, you know, other people got into the movement, the peak oil movement, and there's different things, and, you know, you can, like one part of the case that I saw was the claim that the Saudi Arabian sheiks were, and any other OPEC nations, but Saudi Arabia in particular, were exaggerating how much oil they had in reserve. And so the peak oil theorists were claiming the world does not have as much readily available oil as the official statistics would have us believe, that actually Saudi Arabia's figures in particular are grossly overstated. So again, these people aren't sixth graders. I mean, they weren't claiming every last drop of oil is going to disappear by the year 2035. They were just saying we're going to soon hit a point at which the marginal cost of extracting oil are going to go through the roof, because instead of just pumping it up effortlessly from Saudi Arabia, you know, we're going to have to send rigs out and drill underneath the ocean and all that kind of stuff. And it's way more expensive per barrel to pull up oil that way than what we've got going on in the Middle East right now. So their point was, if the OPEC nations were more transparent about their true situation, then, you know, things would be different, and the market price of oil would be much higher than it is right now. And then, and there's different theorists, of course, in the movie. They all had different views, but typically people who were worried about peak oil would think this is why we should start on a crash course developing alternative technology, that we don't want to still be this dependent on petroleum when production starts declining and there's nothing we can do about it, because just the marginal cost of extraction are way higher than we currently think the current official estimates suggest they'll be. Yeah, right. So it was Hubbard is the guy's name. So again, I'm just going off this from memory. Don't quote me on this, but I think he got a lot of credibility because his call about the United States was right. That, you know, before it happened, he gave a rough time frame of when U.S. oil production would peak. And then that turned out to be true. But I think his prediction for world oil output was not true. And I, off the top of my head, I don't remember what he said, but like he missed the window and world oil output keeps going up. And then the other thing too is, you know, what do you mean by oil? I mean, if you include natural gas, then it's not even close with the, you know, fracking revolution, all that stuff. But it's also true, I think if you revisited his claims, even though he was right in the short term, I mean, there's projections now that the U.S. is going to overtake Saudi Arabia in oil production. But again, depending on how broadly you define oil, like what are we talking about? Just crude oil, or are we including natural gas and, you know, that kind of stuff? That the U.S. is going to overtake Saudi Arabia within, you know, the next 10 years, something like that. So it's the U.S.'s position in the oil markets is a lot different now from what it was perceived to be like in 1985. So, but anyway, that's the thing. Now, as far as what, you know, the economics of it or whatever, I mean, it's true. At some point in history, oil production, as we conventionally define it, is probably going to peak and then decline. Just because I think technologies will evolve, and that I would be surprised if humans in the year 2500 still had engines that ran on some sort of derivative of petroleum. And I'm just guessing they would probably do something else. Just like we don't use horses right now for transportation, at least not in very many areas, whereas that was kind of a big deal, you know, in the Roman Empire or something. So I can imagine that at some point, if you look at the statistics, it would be the case that, oh yeah, oil production peaked in this year and then it declined thereafter, but not because it also would be true to say, oh, and the reason that happened is economically it made sense to move to something else. But typically the peak oil theorists are making it sound like it's going to be a catastrophe and we're going to have no choice but to move to something else because it's simply going to be unaffordable, as opposed to saying better alternatives will come our way. And, you know, then we'll just abandon the use of petroleum because why would we do that anymore? Well, now we can, you know, got cold fusion or whatever. So that's my prediction. And that doesn't flow from economic science per se. And that's coupled with my judgments about empirically looking over the historical record and seeing how humanity evolved in the context of relatively free markets. So yeah, I would be more confident in the stuff I just said if you could tell me the governments around the world are going to liberalize their restrictions and they're going to, you know, stop meddling in energy markets in particular. I would be more confident about what I just said. Okay, let's see. I mean, let me just, this is kind of a good general point here. And Art Carden, actually, on Econ Lib, I don't know, about a month ago, had a good post that made this point, saying, you know, I think the title of this post is, "We will never, ever, ever run out of oil." I think he was making a play on the Taylor Swift song about when we're never, ever going to get back together again, or whatever her song is. And in and of itself, that's neither optimistic nor pessimistic to say the earth is never going to run out of oil. And he used the analogy of a tube of toothpaste and to say, you know, how with each successive application of it, you know, every time you brush your teeth, the marginal difficulty of extracting, you know, the amount that you use to brush your teeth either stays roughly the same or eventually starts rising. And then when the tube is almost empty, you know, it gets really tricky to, you know, squeeze out enough to brush your teeth. And at some point you throw the tube out and you go buy another one. But the point is, when you throw that tube out, technically, is it literally devoid of every last bit of toothpaste? No. And it's the same thing with oil, that no matter what happens, there will always be oil buried deep somewhere in the earth. And to say that, you know, that's neither optimistic nor pessimistic, whether it's we're all flourishing because we've developed cold fusion or solar technology, or you know, geothermal has advanced to such a degree that why would anyone even bother using oil anymore, even though you get it $2 a barrel, or because it gets so difficult to extract that oil shoots up to $800 a barrel and people are starving and there's mass famines and stuff. Either way, the earth doesn't run out of oil, but it's still important to get people to start thinking like that, to at least clarify and make sure you're thinking about it the right way. Because the typical discussions are, oh my gosh, we're going to run out of oil in 30 years. And that's just, that kind of statement is wrong on so many levels that, it, you know, you got to spend time just establishing, well, no, we're never going to run out of oil. Think through the logic of this and then how resource usage works. Okay. Let me see. I've got somebody posting a comment. He says, Bob, United States and Britain are becoming more authoritarian. If the process continues, where would you suggest as a more libertarian place for exile? Okay, well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, Keith, I'm going to try to dodge that simply because I haven't done – I mean, I'm staying here. I have a young son, and at least for the foreseeable future, you know, it's not my decision as to – it's not my sole decision as to where whether he's going to stay in the United States or not. And so, in any event, for the foreseeable future – he's here, so I'm here for sure. And it's also for me, things might change, but I'm kind of all in at this point. That I think where I could do the most good is being here. And even if it turns into we all get rounded, you know, all the outspoken dissidents get rounded up in the FEMA camps. I mean, I'm sort of just exaggerating to make this Saturday morning office hour session interesting in case some of you guys are hungover or something, but I'm also being serious. I mean, if it ever did come to that, I still kind of think I would do more good for humanity being in the FEMA camps and encouraging the people in there and, you know, trying to bargain with the guards and stuff and saying, well, hey, look, you know, if we behave this way, you guys behave this way, is that a deal? You know, and I think I can do better than that. Like, just like, you know, Henry Hazlitt and guys like that, who John Flynn, I mean, they chronicled what happened during the New Deal in the 30s. And, you know, and Hazlitt, as far as I know, never fled the United States, even though he certainly witnessed firsthand a huge transformation in the role of government in the United States. And I think that that was good that he was on the spot chronicling what happened, and the same thing with me. So I'm not saying that for everybody else in particular, you know, people who are young and don't have roots right now, especially, yeah, if you have skills that you can easily relocate the skills you have, then yeah, the world's the limit. But like I say, since I don't have any plans myself on leaving anytime soon, I haven't been doing research. And so it would be irresponsible of me just to throw stuff out because, you know, on the off chance somebody does what I say and they go move to some country because I just fire my mouth off, I would feel funny about that. So, unfortunately, I don't know. I mean, Bob Higgs, for example, is moving to Mexico. He found like a little town that he thought was kind of small enough that nobody's going to, you know, that neither the government nor the drug unions really care about. And so, I mean, that's what he's doing. You know, other famous libertarian-ish people are, you know, moving to, you know, the Asian areas, thinking that that's going to be
the wave of the 21st century, you know, that Great Britain was the 19th century, the United States was the 20th century, and that Asia, you know, whether that means China or just that region in general, is going to be the 21st century. And if I had to guess, that sounds right to me. But, you know, that's kind of a huge culture barrier to go move to Hong Kong or something. So, or Malaysia or whatever. So anyway, I'm not really answering your question. I'm just explaining why I'm staying here, at least for the foreseeable future. So whatever you end up doing, though, let me say this. This will be perhaps useful somewhat. What I tell people when they ask me that kind of stuff and say, you know, when should we leave? What I would say if I were you is right now, think through and say, you know, what would the government have to do to make me decide, you know what, I don't want to even be in this country anymore. I got to get out of here. Because, I mean, there's, you know, we're glad that Ludwig von Mises fled Nazi Germany, right? That's a good thing that he didn't stick around to go down with the ship. So I'm not saying it's impossible. And so I think that's what I would tell people to do who are seriously thinking along those lines and you're just not sure. I would say write it down, because what happens is as you stay in a country, you know, just with your daily life, the government's probably not going to just go from it being like it is right now to all of a sudden rounding everybody up and there's black helicopters literally overhead that people can see every day and there's drones flying around and the next Tuesday. You know, it'll be more of a gradual thing and you just get this growing perception that it's turning into a police state, so which many of us are recognizing right now. So I'm saying I think what you should do is write a letter to yourself or something, you know, and then check it every birthday or whatever you want to do. Have some system whereby you can, you know, right now codify a list of things and say, you know, if the government ever did this, this, or this, then I know I really have to put my house on the market and get the heck out of here or whatever it is. So that's what I would encourage you to do, because otherwise your standards might just... Probably 10 years ago, if you said to somebody, okay, if you were living in the United States and the New York Times came out with a funny story about how the president has a secret list of American citizens that he's going to kill with flying robots with no trial, would you say that it was time to leave? Probably people would say, well, that's never going to happen. Even if the president was doing that, it wouldn't be on the front page of the New York Times. Ha, ha, ha. And yet it was. Well, I guess I don't know if it was on the front page, but it was in the New York Times that President Obama, recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize, has a list of American citizens slated to be killed, and he could use flying killer robots to do it, and they have no trial or anything. It's just, you know, the executive branch's determination that they're terrorists, and that's in the New York Times. So, but since we see it, you know, now we can just kind of take it in stride and we're used to it and make jokes about it. And whereas objectively, that's shocking. So I'm just saying you get desensitized to all the stuff the government does. So if I were you, I would write out a list of things. And yeah, I mean, there's just so much involved with where would you go. So there's no place that I know of that, oh yeah, that's a libertarian paradise. I mean, there's like, there's guys in Chile, I know, that have this thing called Galt's Gulch. And I've heard good things from people who went down there and gave up, but I've never been there. I don't know much about it, except I vaguely know the people involved in the project. So, I mean, you can look at stuff like that and Google, you know, but I guess what I would do if I were you is try to get in direct touch with people who have already gone, who, you know, U.S. expats who are currently living in these places, and then talk to them and see what they think. And don't just talk to somebody who is trying to sell you a lot in the place, because obviously they're going to have every incentive to make it look like, oh, yeah, this is a libertarian paradise. Okay, let's see. Matt Miller asks, are you familiar with Robert Bryce's work? He's not a libertarian, but he has done a lot of work on energy economics and seems to reach some of the same conclusions. I read one of his books and it was very compelling.
Yeah, man. Actually, Robert Bryce very briefly was associated with the Institute for Energy Research. I don't remember if he was officially a scholar with us or whatever. But I mean, I met him at an IER event. You know, like we would go around giving presentations on energy economics and the, you know, federal oil energy policy, especially the effect of the oil market. And Robert Bryce was with us on a couple of those deals. So yeah, I mean, I do know him, perfectly pleasant guy. And so his thing is, he was trying to, and I can't even remember if it was just because of his background or just he decided, you know, this was the approach he was going to take. But yeah, you're right. I don't think he's a libertarian. In fact, I almost think he used to be more, I don't want to say an environmentalist, but sympathetic to sort of what we consider to be left-wing causes. And then I think he just kind of learned the facts and then like had a complete, you know, transformation in his views. And so he's, so yeah, if you were going to try to convince a self-described democratic liberal, democratic with a capital D, somebody who votes for Democrats in U.S. elections, talking about oil issues or whatever, Robert Bryce would probably be a better introduction to free market energy economics than Robert Murphy. So just because the way he would try to, you know, the objections he would deal with and the way he would try to communicate things, I think a self-described liberal Democrat reading his stuff would be like, oh yeah, I never thought of that. Whereas, you know, the way I present my case, it would probably come off like I care more about efficiency than poor people or something. Okay. And yeah, I mean, as far as the quality of his work, I know which book you're talking about, probably. It's like the one with the, it's like a Picasso kind of riff on the cover or something like that, with like oil dripping or something. So yeah, I haven't read the book cover. I'm familiar with, okay, we're talking about a different book. Okay, no, I haven't read that book at all. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm talking about his earlier one. It had oil in the title. And anyway, you know, I've seen op-eds and stuff that he was writing for various outlets. And it was, because it was mostly, let me put it this way. I don't think he knew all the fine nuances of economics, but he was very knowledgeable about the facts. And that, and with this stuff, I mean, that's a lot of, you know, that's half the battle, as G.I. Joe might say, knowing is half the battle, that with a lot of the standard discussions that we see in the United States over energy policy, a lot of the stuff people say is just so devoid of factual information that, you know, people just talking about, oh, well, we should just, you know, have electric cars by 2020 or something, or we should have half the U.S. fleet be running electric cars and the rest natural gas by 2030, without even thinking through, well, wait a minute, part of the reason, you know, beyond the difficulties in having batteries and so forth with electric cars is also the issue of if you're on a long road trip, you know, you need to have refueling stations. You know, right now the U.S. infrastructure is designed so that gasoline-powered vehicles can stop every 10 miles on the interstate and refill. And so it's not merely a question of getting all the motorists to switch over and buy electric cars. You also have to get a complete transformation in the infrastructure, you know, to replace what the way we're currently doing things. So I mean, just stuff like that where, you know, it somebody might say something. So that's why we need state and local governments to spend billions of dollars revamping, blah, blah, blah. But at least the person recognizes that issue, whereas some people are so naive, they don't even think of that. They just talk about, well, yeah, I mean, you could save money by having an electric car. And, you know, so why doesn't everyone get an electric car? You don't have to pay for gasoline anymore. And that's what I'm saying. Bryce is really good. He knows a lot of the facts. And so his discussion, at least, is reality-based, to use the term that guys like Krugman like. Okay, you know, as far as, I see Malcolm coming back to the Saudi reserves thing when I was talking about peak oil. I mean, what do I think about that? Well, is it possible that a government-sponsored cartel of oil-producing countries is lying about the true supply situation? Yeah, of course it is. Of course that's possible. But I'm not sure. I mean, it's a little bit weird. At first blush, you would think, why would Saudi Arabia do that? In other words, Saudi Arabia right now is selling a bunch of oil, right? That's their primary export. That's what gives them strength. So if they said to the world, oh, by the way, we actually don't have as much buried under the sand as you previously thought, that would make the price of oil go up. So if they continued their current output, they would make, whatever, twice as much money by saying that. So at first blush, it's a little bit weird. Why would they lie in order to make themselves less money? See what I'm saying? And, you know, and so it's, now there could be kind of geopolitical intrigue going on and that I'm not thinking it through fully that, well, maybe if people thought they were, you know, Saudi Arabia was going to run out of oil in 10 years at current production rates, that would make the U.S. and Russia behave differently in terms of their foreign policy, and the Saudi Arabian, you know, power elite doesn't want that to happen, so they're trying to postpone the crisis. I get that there's all kinds of stuff like that, but I'm saying at the very least, the people pushing the peak oil theory, I've never seen them adequately explain why would it be in the interest of the OPEC nations to keep the price of oil artificially low when they're selling oil. You know, you could easily imagine people who hate big business making the opposite claim that, I mean, that's what they say about motor vehicles, right? They say stuff like, oh, there's technology to make a car that could get 300 miles to the gallon, but, you know, Exxon bought the patent on that and isn't developing it because they want to keep, you know, the price of oil high and keep making their big fat profits, right? And so, I mean, it's weird that often the same person has two simultaneous theories about why big oil interests are simultaneously keeping the price of oil artificially low and artificially high. So, okay, let's see. George Smith says, I recall from an earlier course that you were finishing up a book on human action. Is that available yet? No, it's not available yet. I'm actually, this month, this August, I'm hoping to knock that thing out completely. It's just other stuff takes longer than you end up anticipating, and so I haven't been able to sit down and bang that thing out. But yeah, so for people who don't know what we're talking about, for the Independent Institute, they commissioned me to do a sort of like a modern or an updated version of Human Action. So it's supposed to be, I'm using Human Action as a guide to the content. It's supposed to communicate to the reader the important things that are in Human Action, but the true constraint is it can't be as big as Human Action. But right now, Human Action is too big for most college professors to use in the classroom. And so what I'm supposed to be producing is something that's more manageable in language that an undergrad or intelligent layperson who's not a student could grasp and yet retains as much of the wisdom that's in Human Action as possible. So I don't know exactly when it would be available for purchase, but I'm supposed to be, you know, giving them the manuscript this month. Okay, Malcolm said, is the Coase theorem more about the efficient use of resources and the allocation of costs versus the aggressor victim cost allocations in the Pavlovian framework? Well, sort of. I mean, I would put it this way. The Pavlovian framework implicitly assumes that we know who the, you know, what the proper property rights boundaries are. And so there's a clear cut, you know, if there's a given externality, there's a clear cut aggressor and a clear cut victim. And then the Pavlovian framework just says, well, given that assumed framework,
here's the government policy that would rectify that. And Coase is saying, why are we even assuming at the outset what the answer is supposed to be? Let's not look at it in terms of victim and aggressor. Let's just look at it as there's a conflict here. You know, it takes two to tango. The reason that, you know, so if there's a dentist in an office right next to a massage parlor, you know, and in the massage parlor, they have, you know, real soft music and nature sounds playing. And then occasionally through the wall, they hear the dentist going, woo! And someone like, going, ah, you know, that's not very soothing. And so those two businesses can't operate side by side if the wall allows sound to travel easily through it. And so Coase is saying, rather than just assuming the massage parlor has the property right of keeping out unwanted drilling noises, why are we saying that? There's a reciprocity here. That why couldn't you just assume that the dentist should say, well, no, you know, why don't I have the right on my own property to, you know, use a drill if that's what it takes for me to do my services? And so, you know, that infringes on my rights too. If you're telling me I can't do that anymore, if you're saying to me the only way I can be allowed to continue my business is if I pay a bunch of money to soundproof the wall, right? Or you're telling me I got to move down the street and then buy all the adjacent lots around me, that's a lot of money. So what, you know, why is it automatic that's my fault, right? So Coase is just saying, yeah, let's think through what would be the outcome if there were sufficiently low transaction costs. And then either way, whether you say the massage parlor owner has the right to keep out drilling noises, or if you say the dentist has the right to emit drilling noises from his property, either way, sufficiently low transaction costs, they're going to figure out, they're going to reach the same conclusion. So, under certain assumptions, that, you know, if it doesn't cost that much to just soundproof the wall, well, then that's what they're going to do, regardless of which person gets the property right. It just, you know, the property right assignment will just affect who pays out of pocket to construct the soundproofing or to pay for the soundproofing. It doesn't change the fact that the end result will be the dentist will continue drilling teeth and the massage parlor guy will continue operating there and his clients won't hear drilling noises. And the issue is just going to be who's going to pay for that soundproofing. And so then once you come up with that, then the issue for Coase is, okay, now taking account of the fact that in the real world, transaction costs might not be low enough to get that efficient allocation of resources. And so now the judge or the government regulator has to be careful and should, assessing the situation and seeing what would happen with a particular assignment of property rights, assign a property right such that same efficient outcome is achieved. Because it's not automatic that it will be achieved if transaction costs are too high. So one thing that screws people up a lot is the word efficient or efficiency in mainstream economics does not refer to fairness. I mean, it's a technical term to describe the condition of the use of the resources, basically meaning you don't want there to be potential gains from trade on the table. If there's a way to make somebody better off and other people the same, then you should do it. And once you allow for side payments, then it even broadens the notion of what's inefficient, because now if you can make a change that at least one person, you know, the winners from that change, the amount they would be willing to pay to achieve it is higher than the amount that the losers would be willing to pay to not have it done, well, then you should make the change. If you could then, you know, take the money from the winners and then redistribute it to the losers. Now everybody, well, minus $10, now everybody's better off according to his or her own subjective preferences. So that's the logic of it. And that's what the different criteria for efficiency. Like there's Pareto efficiency and then there's Kaldor-Hicks efficiency and things like that. But that's the logic behind it. So one thing that blows people's minds a lot, and I would do this with my students, different things could be efficient. In other words, you could give a situation and there's lots of outcomes. Typically, there's an infinity of outcomes that are all Pareto efficient or Pareto optimal. So don't think that in a given situation, efficient means one particular outcome. All right, so that's another thing that when you really get into this stuff can happen. Okay, let's see. Yeah, so Keith is just talking about how Britain is also becoming more authoritarian, just like the United States is, and that, you know, he's thinking about leaving. Let's see. Oh, we got another one in the Q&A box. Rob says, could you comment on the outlook for nuclear energy in the near future, worldwide, as opposed to the U.S.? I mean, yeah, I can comment a little bit, Rob, but I don't know all that much about nuclear in the world. I mean, United States, I don't think they're going to approve a nuclear plant anytime soon, and especially with the revolutions in the natural gas industry, I don't see why they would. So, you know what I'm saying? In other words, no, it's not like the United States needs nuclear power or else our way of life is going to have to change dramatically. So, I don't see that they're going to overcome the political obstacles because this, you know, if you're in Congress or something, you don't want to be voting for allowing more nuclear waste to go be put someplace. You know, it's really tricky for that kind of thing because it sounds so scary. So I don't think there's going to be much development of nuclear in the United States. As far as the rest of the world, like I say, it's not like I follow the nuclear sector very closely. So there's nothing off the top of my head that I can say to you, oh yeah, I hear that such and such country, you know, their government's really pro-nuclear, so let's look for what happens over there. I don't know of anything like that. So anyway, I suppose what could happen is if for some reason there was a worldwide coordinated government crackdown on carbon dioxide emissions, then I could imagine in certain countries where they don't have a lot of natural gas, because natural gas has lower carbon content than coal. I could see that maybe in certain countries where they turn to nuclear, that's just the most cost effective thing, as long as their government, you know, doesn't have a lot of bureaucracy in the way. But other than that, so I'm not really telling you too much here, but that's kind of what I would say. Let's see. Let me just also just comment. A lot of times people say, you know, in a free society, would there be a lot of nuclear power or not? And that's a tough question, because it's for sure it's true that there are a lot of government barriers right now to erecting a new nuclear power plant. But what's not clear is the liability issue. And so, you know, even in a totally free society, if you wanted to start a nuclear power plant, I'm thinking, you know, probably the way it would have to happen is you would need an insurance company to come along and say to the local residents, you know, to get them to agree with that if heaven forbid, you know, there should be a leak, you know, you'll get compensated, and, you know, according to the schedule of damage payouts. And that, you know, so that would probably make the residents more willing to agree to have this power plant located 5 miles away from the house. And then, and whether, you know, if they build a power plant first, but then they're selling property around, I mean, no matter what, clearly the way it's going to affect land value and things, I mean, there would be co-seen and side payments available. So even if the local residents didn't have the legal authority to bar the plant from opening, you know, it'd be the kind of thing where they could just, you know, pay the person to say, well, don't put a nuclear site, you know, we'll pay you X amount of dollars if you locate it 50 miles away, that kind of thing. So I'm not sure exactly how it would play out in terms of, you know, the insurance company then would be the one that would send in its inspectors and make sure there was 19 different fail-safe mechanisms. You know, they would study what happened in Japan and say, well, holy cow, if there's a tornado that comes through and then the water doesn't work and the electricity's out and you know, if all these 16 things happened all at once, could there possibly be a meltdown? And it goes to that. It's another possibility too is, you know, maybe they would have it in relatively sparsely populated regions. And that's another obvious way to deal with it is that, you know, if the real issue is you wouldn't want to have a radiation leak smack dab in the middle of a bustling city with hundreds of thousands of people who all live within a mile, well, then maybe you do have some nuclear reactors, but they're located in an area where this wouldn't be the end of the world if they had a moderate leak. So, you know, that's a possibility too. So what we can say for sure is in a free society, all of these various competing things would be rationally accounted for, whereas now you've got kind of arbitrary government regulations to make it the public think they're being kept safe, but they're also overriding the liability issue. And so if there's two things the government does regarding nuclear power, that it's not obvious. So what I'm saying is, in case you're not getting with the latter point, like right now, if a bunch of private investors open up a nuclear power plant, and there's certain like caps on the liability that the government puts in place. So even if there's a radiation leak and 1 million people die, the private investors, you know, they're not on the hook for like a $100 billion payout. Because if they were, then nobody would have to do it. You know, why would you open a nuclear power plant if you were on the hook for that potential catastrophic payout? So that's what I'm saying in terms of it's not obvious what would happen to free society and how would that potential liability issue play out. But I think it would play out much more rationally than it does in the current system. Okay. Malcolm says, what do you think are the most complex problems we face with regards to environmentalism and voluntary private law society? Example, privatization of the oceans or others. Let's see. I suppose, I guess it depends what we're talking about. If we mean the whole earth is a private law society, then I don't think it'd be that hard at all. What would be kind of tricky is that for certain regions where what we're thinking, what we're talking about is a free society in a sort of Rothbardian perspective, and then they're, you know, an oasis in a desert of states. Because then it gets tricky as to how would they interact with the legal system in the states, and how do you deal with you know, what if we've got a neighboring state that is emitting all kinds of pollution that's, you know, coming into your property and that kind of stuff. So, and then also, how could the judges in the free society, like, how could they start assigning property rights in the ocean or in near Earth orbit? Because that's an issue too about, you know, it didn't matter in 1970, but now there's all kinds of stuff orbiting Earth because, you know, we keep sending up satellites and things, and then just debris up there now because of all the space missions and whatever. And so it's getting messy. It's my understanding, and that, you know, it's now a scarce resource. The volume of space in near Earth orbit. And so there should be some kind of way to allocate property there. And what if you got a satellite up there and then, you know, somebody's doing something a few radians in orbit away from your deal and it's like emitting debris that smacks your satellite, you know, can you sue them or how does that work? So things like that are tricky. And it's, like I say, if the whole thing, the whole planet or a large portion of it were under the jurisdiction, as it were, of competing private voluntary judges, where their rulings would just sort of have the force of law only insofar as the communities recognize, oh yeah, that's a really just ruling and I'm going to abide by those principles. I don't think it'd be a problem at all. What would be tricky is allocating those property rights, like I say, in a mixed world. So to answer your question, I don't think it's stuff like CO2 emissions. So that would be a hard problem to deal with if it were really a problem. I don't think it is. You know, I'm not saying the whole thing is a hoax or an ethic, but I think the estimates are that it's not going to be a catastrophe anytime soon. And I think if it were, like, in other words, if in the year 2050, on the basis of more information, you know, the scientists at that time were saying, no, this is really a serious issue, I think at that point they're going to have much better ability to even directly suck CO2 out of the atmosphere if they have to than compared to right now. And so, as opposed to right now, it making sense to cause trillions of dollars of forfeited economic output by having a crash course of massive CO2 emission reductions. And so, in terms of stuff like that, like you say, I think the trickiest thing would be assigning property rights in natural resources right now that are currently either literally unowned, that not even governments claim ownership, or that governments nominally control, but that are kind of a free-for-all. So, yeah, the ocean in particular is tricky because, you know, if it's in international waters, you know, that's kind of a free-for-all. And then also, like you're mentioning, stuff like owning a humpback whale. I mean, so if you're going to privatize the ocean, what does that mean? Are you going to own the volume of, you know, cubes of ocean, and that's the way you're defined by latitude and longitude and depth? Is that how we're going to define ownership, or are you going to own an individual humpback whale or something, and then wherever that thing swims, that's yours? And so you can make analogies, I think, with cattle and real estate, and just look at, you know, well, how did they deal with those sorts of issues as, you know, the West was one, to use a very imperialist perspective, that, you know, in the United States, as the white man sort of went westward, bringing European notions of property rights to what was originally kind of just the wild open range, and then certain people had their herds of cattle, and they had cowboys and stuff, and then the cattle would graze, you know. So you'd brand your cattle so that if it wandered off, you could recognize, hey, that's mine. But then they started closing the region, You know, so what happens if I find somebody else's animal eating my grass? You know, that kind of stuff.
Okay, well, we're over time here, and I think I've answered most of your guys' questions. So thanks, everybody, for tuning in. I will post, I'm a little bit behind today, I'll post the quiz for week 5, and then in a couple of days I'll post the final exam for those of you, I've got a storm coming here, for those of you who are taking the course for credit. Okay, thanks, guys. I will see you in a future class, perhaps.